From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, environmental health expert Dr. Richard Jackson reveals why our health is affected by how our neighborhoods are designed. And award-winning songwriter Carol Bayer Sager discusses her new memoir, They're Playing Our Song. But first, the presidential election is just around the corner, yet many voters are still undecided about voting for any of the main candidates. And there are others who simply want to learn more about the policies of third-party presidential candidates before making their final decision. And so today, we'll hear from two alternative candidates as they debate the issues in a special presidential forum. They are Dr. Jill Stein of the Green Party and former New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson of the Libertarian Party. The first question, we'll start with you, Dr. Stein. In a presidential election year where the two major party candidates have both had favorability issues and trust issues, why has your campaign not picked up more ground? It seems that this is a tailor-made election for a third-party candidate to rise.
It absolutely is. And the American people are clamoring for other voices and other choices. These are the most disliked and untrusted candidates in our history. Unfortunately, we have a system that is very carefully firewalled in order to protect the political establishment so that real challengers like Governor Johnson and myself are basically excluded from coverage. We have to fight very hard in order to get on the ballot, and we are excluded from the debates. This is a case in point. Donald Trump got $4 billion worth of free primetime televised media. Hillary Clinton got $2 billion. We got virtually none. I think the governor got a little bit more than I did, but we were basically shut out compared to the other two candidates. So, you know, this is what the American people are demanding. This is what we should be giving them. And thank you for actually making this possible.
A few more seconds you still have left here. Let me just ask this question quickly then. Some have suggested that the Democrats need to rethink. I saw a piece in the Chicago Tribune the other day that Democrats ought to press her to step down now because of this new scandal regarding emails. You agree with that assessment by the Tribune or not?
You know, my feeling is that the FBI's reopening the case is very poorly timed and irresponsible. This should not be done days before an election. I think the issues have already been there and are not new to Hillary Clinton's voters, but I think that there were already enough reasons on the table for people not to trust Hillary Clinton and for her not to be in the White House, and I would say the same of Donald Trump.
Governor Johnson, same question for you. In this election season, when the table seems set for a third-party candidate to rise, with both candidates being disliked and not trusted, why not more success from the Johnson campaign?
You know, I'm going to label this as success. Mm-hmm. I got to tell you, six major newspapers endorsing my campaign, the Chicago Tribune being one of the larger newspapers, kind of summarizing what they've said is they said, hey, you know what? These guys, Bill Weld and Gary Johnson, may not win, but two former Republican governors that served in heavily Democrat states, these guys made a difference. The things they're saying, fiscally responsible, smaller government, lower taxes, socially inclusive, talking about marriage equality, woman's right to choose, ending the war on drugs, military interventions. Look, let's stop with regime change. And that free markets are a good thing. They'll result in more U.S. jobs, not less U.S. jobs. They said, look at what these guys are saying. In 10 years, all candidates will be talking about the issues that they're talking about now. So vote on principle, Americans. Vote on principle. This is how you're going to change things. This is what we're doing. Like I say, these guys may not win, but we're going to take a principled stand here, and we think that'll make a difference.
In 15 seconds, same follow-up for Dr. Stein to you. Do you think that the Democrats ought to be pressing Secretary Clinton to step aside, to do anything different given this new scandal regarding these emails?
Well, I think it's just very, very significant that he would raise this, having dropped it earlier. Clearly, there has to be something there, and if he weren't to raise it, he would be under worse criticism going forward than he is now. So I just think that starting on day one, I think Hillary Clinton is going to be engaged in impeachment process if, in fact, she is elected.
Let's move on now to the next question. Governor Johnson, this question goes to you first. You oppose the minimum wage, but can anyone really live on $7 an hour?
Well, it's a minimum wage. It's labeled a minimum wage. So something I say tongue-in-cheek, and I do say this tongue-in-cheek, why not raise the minimum wage to $75 an hour? Well, I think everybody gets it immediately, and that is, well, gosh, how can we afford $75 an hour? Nobody can pay that. Well, how is it that government can assign a wage to begin with? I just think that the market should prevail. I think it results in less jobs for kids entering into the marketplace and minimum wage. Look, minimum wage is minimum wage. It's not livable wage. And for me, having been in the private sector my entire life, I had 1,000 employees growing a business from a one-person operation to 1,000 people. Minimum wage was never an issue because nobody got less than, no one got even paid the minimum wage. Show up on time, wear clean clothes, good work ethic. Hey, we're not talking about minimum wage. We're talking about a wage that you can live on.
You got 30 seconds left. If the minimum wage, if your argument is that the market ought to decide, that means that poor people have their fate at the hands of the market. Is that really what you want us to accept?
Well, what I want people to understand is that we're restricting jobs, that the more you raise the minimum wage, the more and more automation occurs. I mean, you force the marketplace into automation. Do you know what's going to be one of the biggest disruptors here very shortly is the fact that the number one occupation in the United States is driver. And because we're going to have automated driving, trucks, taxis, I will tell you, this is going to be a gigantic disruptor moving forward. And fast food, that is also going to be subject to automation in a really big way. So these are issues. Big issues.
Let me cut in with a slightly different question, still on the same topic for you, Dr. Stein. You call for raising the minimum wage, unlike Governor Johnson, but there are those who think that $15 an hour isn't even enough, that it hasn't kept up with the rate of inflation. How do you respond to that?
I think they're right, and I see $15 an hour only as a beginning, but it's an essential beginning. And we know that actually when we are priming the pump of the economy by putting more dollars into the hands of consumers, we actually grow jobs. So it's a myth that decent wages depress the economy or suppress jobs. They're actually very good for the economy. And we have serious problems in our economy right now where basically 75% of our wealth is concentrated into the hands of just 10%, the upper 10%. And the lower 50% has 1% of the wealth. This is not sustainable. 43 million people are in poverty, and it's something like 13%, but it's twice as many African Americans. We cannot have an economy that only works for the very wealthy and the very few. This is an economy in free fall. This is a stagnating economy. We need our economy to actually reflect our values and to ensure that it's working for everyone, not an economy that puts profit over people. My campaign is calling for a different kind of economy and a different society that puts people over profit.
This question goes to you, Dr. Stein. You have argued that the U.S. should peg its gun control policies to other countries like Norway and Australia who established gun buyback programs. Is that really the meat of your argument about gun control and gun rights and a gun buyback program? Is that really it?
No, okay. By no means. No, I mean, that's actually just something we note in passing, that other countries have done buybacks. I don't think that will work for us. Right now, we are a very divided and fearful society in which racism abounds and bias, prejudice, and fear abound. So we actually call for the improvements that the American people are calling for. We're not talking about a radical departure. We're calling for ensuring that the gun show loophole closes, that there are background checks, and that we get automatic weapons, basically military-scale weapons, off the streets, and that we get rid of this impunity to gun manufacturers and distributors so that they are held accountable for the misuse of their weapons and for putting those weapons into the wrong people's hands. But we also call for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission so we can come to terms with the abundant racism and fear that pervades our society. If we're going to actually move forward and become a less violent society, it's not just a matter of getting rid of the irresponsible guns out there and the guns that are in dangerous hands, but actually a addressing the issues of fear, bias, and racism through a Truth and Reconciliation Commission and a deep discussion about race at our community levels.
Governor Johnson, this question is for you. You, conversely, oppose any restrictions on firearms. I guess the question is, should we bear arms in schools or churches? Should people on the no-fly list be allowed to have guns?
Well, one of the... So, first of all, I support the Second Amendment. Having said that, should we be open to a discussion and a debate on how we keep guns out of the hands of the mentally ill? Absolutely. Should we be open to a debate and a discussion on how we keep guns out of the hands of would-be terrorists? Absolutely. As President of the United States, I would love to know what transpired between the FBI and the shooter in Orlando. I'd love to know what transpired between the FBI and the recent bomber in New York. Clearly, the system is working up to a certain point, but is it an issue of more resources that it could be more effective moving forward? If that's the case, as President of the United States, I would allocate those resources. No automatic weapons are allowed in this country. Those were banned decades ago. And currently, semi-automatic weapons, the kind of which are now, many are labeled assault rifles, there are about 40 million rifles in that category. So if you're going to make those semi-automatic rifles illegal, you're going to make a new category, I think, of criminal in this country that otherwise would not be criminal.
Very quickly here, though, when you say we ought to be open to a debate and a discussion about whether persons on the no-fly list have weapons, why a debate or discussion as opposed to an emphatic no? No one on the no-fly list should have access to a weapon.
Well, because currently on the no-fly list are active members of Congress. For one thing, so one of the issues I believe is just an expedient way to address if you are on the no-fly list and shouldn't be there. Is there an expedient way that you can get off of that? And I believe that that's an issue of resource. But currently, it's a bit on the cumbersome side. And I'll just point out, current members of Congress currently on the no-fly list.
This question is for you, Governor Johnson. You would repeal the Affordable Care Act, but so many low-income Americans benefit, as you well know, from extension of Medicaid. How would your plan address the poor's lack of access to health care?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's realistic that we're going to repeal our health care. But when it comes to health care, what we need to do is to bring a free market approach to health care. And by the way, health care is as far removed from free market as it possibly can be. If we had a free market approach to health care, we would not have insurance to cover ourselves for ongoing medical need. We would have insurance to cover ourselves for catastrophic injury and illness, and we would pay as you go in a system that would be absolutely competitive and offer lower prices. So there's no advertised pricing. There's no advertised outcome. When you go to the doctor, you have no idea what it's going to cost. You can't shop the health care that you have. You could have health care savings accounts. I think that having health insurance to cover yourself for ongoing medical need is analogous to having grocery insurance. Imagine, and something we don't have, but imagine the grocery shopping experience if you had grocery insurance. Go to the grocery store, no prices on the counters whatsoever. When it comes to ground round or filet, I'm going to have to take filet every single time because I have grocery insurance. I just think that there are so many ways that the government could create real competition in the healthcare area, allowing us to buy prescriptions from Canada. How long would the high prices of prescriptions exist in this country if we were allowed to buy in Canada? They would last about a nanosecond.
Dr. Stein, this question is for you. Speaking of healthcare, you have denounced Big Pharma as corrupt and abusive. If my research is true, you have either held or hold stock investments in the pharmaceutical giant Merck. If that is true, tell me yes, and if so, why?
So I actually gave up, sold, divested from Merck. I will say that my husband still has some Merck. We have separate financial policies. Mm-hmm. I have divested from Merck, from GE, from DuPont, from the real bad actors out there, and am predominantly invested in index funds and mutual funds that are broadly distributed into an economy which is very problematic and which is dominated, again, by pharmaceuticals, by health insurance, by war profiteering, by fossil fuel industries. And I am interested in moving my money in order to support better investment. But, you know, I think it's really important that we fight for change regardless. So most investors actually are part of this reprehensible economy, and that should not stop us from fighting to change that economy, which is critical.
This question is for you, Dr. Stein. Your plan to lower the national debt is to end, as you call it, neoliberal austerity measures and to increase spending. For those who hear those two things as counterintuitive, maybe even counterproductive, mm-hmm. how do you respond?
Yeah, so it's widely understood now by many economists that in the presence of a recession or an economy that is struggling, that austerity is the worst thing that you can do, that it is counterproductive, that it prevents the economy from recovering. We know that, for example, from the experience in Europe with Greece, for example. We know that from U.S. experience prior to the Great Depression. Recently, the International Money Fund issued a report saying that austerity is exactly the wrong thing that you need to invest in the economy. The Federal Reserve said the same thing. So we're calling for prudent investments to recreate a productive economy. What I'm calling for, a Green New Deal, is the antidote to NAFTA and to the Trans-Pacific Partnership and to these so-called trade agreements, which are basically crony capitalist trade agreements that send our jobs overseas and depress our wages here at home. Instead, we need to be creating these jobs here at home and growing our way out of this debt.
Governor Johnson, this question is for you. As a fiscal conservative, how do you explain that when you were elected governor of New Mexico, you inherited a debt of $1.8 billion but left office with a debt of $4.6 billion?
That is absolutely horse is what that is. I have no idea where that came from. I actually saw that article, and I have no idea. There is absolutely no basis in fact for that. None.
All right. Enough said. Gary Johnson, we will go to this question then. This is for you. You oppose cap and trade, because you've said so many times, and yet acknowledge man-made climate change. So how do you propose that we fight global warming?
Well, I think the free market, if you use coal as an example, has basically has actually bankrupted marginal coal at the moment. Right now, coal makes up about 36% of our electrical load. And right now, nobody's going to build a coal-fired plant because natural gas is much cheaper. So you can figure on coal being phased out. The coal that is currently marketable is the Wyoming coal, and there may be others in this country, but I think the free market has done that. I think you and I as consumers are demanding less carbon emission, and we're seeing that happen. Looking at cap and trade, I was open and would be open as president of the United States and having been governor of New Mexico, I'm open to any discussion that I think might make things better, cost less, work better. So looking at cap and trade, it was that pretense that I was looking at cap and trade that this might actually work. Well, apparently, this is my assessment and many others, is that it's just a bit too complex and that it would actually that it actually wouldn't work.
Before I move on to Dr. Stein, since I got 20 seconds left here, since you called it horse, you know what, what do you recall the deficit was that you left New Mexico with?
Well, I left New Mexico with a $1 billion surplus. And when I took office, you could argue that there was a $1 billion surplus.
Okay. Dr. Stein, your platform has proposed to kick off a job-producing energy program based on clean, safe, and renewable energy. You referenced that earlier in this conversation, and you denounce reliance on coal. But coal is cheap, so how does your energy plan affect poor people?
Great. So, and let me say, it's not just coal, but it is fracking and natural gas as well. Mm-hmm. The science tells us that that is every bit as devastating. In fact, we know that natural gas, also called methane, is 80 times more powerful as carbon dioxide and the usual fossil fuel emissions of carbon dioxide. So it's not like natural gas represents the market taking care of this problem. Not whatsoever. It represents how the market gets stuck in putting profit over people and the planet. And let me tell you how this is good for people. The way this is good for people is that we create a nationally subsidized program to create these jobs in clean, renewable energy, and that we ensure that the cost is affordable. Right now, we pay so much in health care costs related to fossil fuels that by moving to zero fossil fuels, we save so much money, it's actually enough to pay the costs of the green energy transformation. So when you balance out the savings in our health care and the savings in the military, where we no longer need these wars for oil that consume half of our discretionary budget and almost half of your income taxes, we save so much money through those two offsets, also by moving our subsidies, tens of billions of dollars, into green energy subsidies, that we can ensure that this is a win, especially for poor people, because they are the first in line for these jobs, which are good wage, living wage jobs.
This question is for you, Dr. Stein. You want to increase affirmative action programs, yet recent Supreme Court decisions, as you know, have started to limit these programs. How do you respond?
Well, there are various ways that we can ensure that these programs are targeted to the areas of greatest need. So, as you know, unemployment rates are highest in the communities of color, particularly in the African American community. And the way that this Green New Deal works, which is like the New Deal that got us out of the Great Depression, so it's not a hypothetical, it's not an abstraction, it's something we have done before and that we put money into. Those jobs are targeted first to the communities of greatest need, and whether we define that on the basis of communities of color or on the basis of the highest unemployment rates, those jobs will get to the communities of color that need them the most.
Governor Johnson, you are for the abolition of affirmative action. To some people, that might sound a bit, if not racist, racial. How would you respond to that kind of that criticism?
Well, I think that so many of these government programs had a place. And let's just argue for a second that affirmative action was positive. I just think it perhaps has outgrown its positive. I think this is an example of crony capitalism. Crony capitalism, when government picks winners and losers. I think affirmative action, for the most part, is gamed. And that those that know how to game it, game it. And I think we've grown beyond affirmative action.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. The third party presidential forum with Jill Stein of the Green Party and Gary Johnson of the Libertarian Party continues. We will focus on foreign policy. The question is for both of you. For you first, Governor Johnson, are Julian Assange and Edward Snowden heroes or enemies of the state?
Based on what I know about Edward Snowden, and based on what I know is that the information that he made available, which he made available to major news outlets for them to release, because he was afraid if he did that, that he might put people in harm's way, or that people would get hurt as a result of that. To my knowledge, no one has been hurt, and based on that, I would pardon Edward Snowden. I would like to turn the satellites away from the United States. There is a process in this country, due process. Someone suspected of terrorism, go to a judge, get a warrant. But in my opinion, when the NSA, through the FISA court, says we want to tap into 110 million Verizon users, that is not the country that we live in. WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, to my knowledge, what he is doing is releasing information, period. That's what he is doing. I do put Edward Snowden in the hero category. Assange, I think, has been very value-added in revealing information that we all had conjecture over. Hillary Clinton, as an example, saying one thing to Wall Street, saying right. another thing to Main Street.
Dr. Stein, same question for you.
In my view, they are both heroes because they both revealed acts being taken by our government in violation of our constitutional rights. The spying, the mass surveillance, and in the case of Julian Assange, the war crimes that were being committed in our name. And I think it has been invaluable to the American people to be informed about what actually has been going on in violation of our rights, in violation of due process. And in the case of Edward Snowden, corrective action, at least the beginnings of corrective action, have been taken at the congressional level. We would be completely uninformed right now of the massive violation of our right to privacy. So I think they both deserve their freedom, they both deserve pardons, and they both deserve a hero's welcome.
Governor Johnson, again, this question for you. You support the Trans-Pacific Partnership, better known as TPP, yet you said you find it imperfect. In what ways? How would you change it?
Well, I think nothing is perfect, but if there is a takeaway that I've had serving as governor of New Mexico for two terms, the takeaway is to try and sign on to anything that makes things better. Are things perfect? No. Oftentimes, and in that context, I may have vetoed more legislation than the other 49 governors in the country combined. But based on my assessment, and by the way, I'm not doing this, I'm not doing this blindly. I have economics advisors. Jeff Myron is my economics advisor. The staff at Chapman University, the faculty at Chapman University. The consensus, the overwhelming consensus is that TPP is positive, that it would result in more U.S. jobs, that it would eliminate many of the tariffs that exist right now. Is anything perfect? No, but does this advance free trade? It does. And bottom line, free trade, more U.S. jobs, not less U.S. jobs. Crony capitalism, when government picks winners and losers, this advances the government making less of these. In other words, this gets government out of the equation. This advances genuine free trade. Free trade, the opposite of crony capitalism.
Dr. Stein, you have said that TPP fundamentally attacks American democracy and sovereignty. Your words, which existing trade deal do you support, if any?
So there are bilateral trade agreements that the U.S. has, for example, with most countries that are a part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. There are trade deals within Latin America that are based on promoting fair trade, that are based on promoting a more just and fair economy. There are different models of trade deals. You know, I think with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, it's clear what we're getting. This is NAFTA on steroids. This is not a good thing. This is a very bad thing that sent at least a million jobs overseas, that closed about 60,000 factories, that depressed our wages. And perhaps most disturbing of all is this system of investor-state dispute resolution that creates a court that's not even a part of our own domestic courts. These are judges appointed by the World Bank that conduct their own tribunals, that enable corporations to overrule our democratically established laws and regulations that protect our health, our jobs, our environment, even protecting our banking system from financial corruption, a healthcare system in which we can have bulk negotiations with pharmaceutical companies. All of that goes out the window with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's very important that we stop it.
this question goes to you first, Dr. Stein. You both oppose the drone wars, and you both oppose boots on the ground to fight ISIS in Syria and in Iraq. How do you propose, then, that we deal with ISIS or ISIL, if you prefer?
Great. So it's really important to look at the track record here. Every one of these interventions, starting with Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya, has been an utter disaster. Each terrorist group that we have tried to contain in this way is stronger today, has more territory. And with each turn of the cycle of violence, we have a more ferocious and vicious form of terrorism to deal with. Witness ISIS, which grew out of the chaos of Iraq and Libya. So I'm calling for a new kind of offensive in the Middle East, a peace offensive, which begins with a weapons embargo, because currently we are providing the majority of weapons that get into the hands of all parties to the conflict. We are calling for a weapons embargo and a freeze on the bank accounts of those countries, in particular our allies, who are continuing to fund terrorist enterprises around the world. Hillary Clinton herself identified the Saudis as still, long after 9/11, still the major funder of terrorist extremism around the world. So we can take a stand in the right direction, use our moral authority for an intervention that will actually work instead of more of these catastrophes that are bankrupting us, taking more than half of our discretionary budget.
Governor Johnson, how do you fight ISIL?
Well, first of all, we should stop with supporting regime change. If we are attacked, we should attack back. We should have an invincible national defense. But I stress the word defense. And in my lifetime, I can't think of one single example where we have gone in to support regime change where it has turned out positive. We created a vacuum in Iraq when we invaded. We took out Saddam Hussein. We created a vacuum when we went in to support the oust of Assad in Syria. And if you take Aleppo as an example, you've got Assad on the west side of Aleppo. On the east side of Aleppo, you've got the Free Syrian Army, which we supported. And when we supported them, there was all this conjecture that the arms that we gave them would end up in the hands of the Islamists. They were fighting hand in hand with the Islamists to fight Assad. Well, that happened. And also, those arms ended up in the hands of ISIS, Raqqa, which arguably was created because of the void, the vacuum, because of our invasion of Iraq, and that Saddam's henchmen fled to Raqqa. We're supporting the Kurds against ISIS. The Kurds are sideways with our Turkish ally that aren't such a good ally anymore because of our invasion of Iraq. And before any of this started, we gave resources to Assad to fight the Islamists before any of this started.
Dr. Stein, just trying to watch our time. We're on to you now. What would a CIA look like under a Jill Stein administration?
It would be a professional organization which advises the president on what the realities are of the threats to the United States. And the CIA has had integrity in the past, and I think it could going forward. But we need to ensure that it is not enveloped by a military-industrial complex that is ruling the day and that is looking to beat the war drums. You know, it should be neutral. It was certainly politicized under Dick Cheney, who was generating intelligence that was extremely flawed, that helped drive us into the war in Iraq. We need intelligence that is reliable, that is not politicized, and that's going to a White House which has an even hand and which is not funded by the war profiteers, which are pouring money into both the Democratic and Republican parties. It also needs to be free of this revolving door in broader government, where people are moving from the defense industries and the defense contractors into the Department of Defense.
All right. Governor Johnson, this question is for you. You oppose torture. You're clearly on the record about that. Yet you support Guantanamo. How do you reconcile the two?
Well, by support Guantanamo, I am absolutely opposed to Guantanamo for all the reasons that we should be, and that would be torture and detention without being charged. but there does need to be a facility to house those prisoners that have no home. And by have no home, clearly they're guilty. And by the way, this could all be done via military tribunal when it comes to due process, something that is not currently taking place. But if we were to send many of these detainees at Guantanamo back to their home countries, they would end up getting killed. So a facility like this needs to exist. The detainment without being charged still exists. But if we close Guantanamo, we're going to have to open up a similar facility somewhere else. So with one of my problems with Obama is transparency. Just tell us why you didn't close Guantanamo, given the fact that you said you were. And the reason that he's not closing Guantanamo are those things that I'm raising right now, those same reasons.
Well, while you're reconciling, let me ask you another question about how you reconcile something else. You oppose financial aid to Israel, as you do to all countries, in fairness to you, although you favor the continuation of what you call strategic aid to Israel. Is that splitting hairs? How do you reconcile those two statements?
Well, strategic aid, they are a military, they are an ally. And having been to Israel, having visited with Benjamin Netanyahu, Shimon Peres, Ariel Sharon, the big takeaway that I had having visited Israel is that they really don't need our assistance at all. They are best able to determine their own outcomes. And it's really a fallacy, or it's wrong on behalf of the United States to think that we can presume how to answer or to solve the problems that they do have.
Dr. Stein, you have proposed that the U.S. stop arming, using your words here, stop arming and funding governments committing war crimes, among them Israel. Do you believe then that the U.S. support of Israel makes us complicit in the war crimes that are being committed?
Yes, and that applies to Israel. That also applies to Saudi Arabia. And I call for an even-handed foreign policy across the board, where we are very clear, and with all due humility, because we ourselves have been, you know, leading the charge in war crimes and in human rights abuses, mm-hmm. but that as part of turning over a new leaf in our administration, we would inform respectfully our allies that we no longer intend to fund, in the case of Israel, $8 million a day for the Israeli army, which is committing flagrant human rights abuses, war crimes, occupation, home demolitions, assassinations, collective punishment, you name it, just human rights violations across the board. We cannot continue to sanction that, not in the case of Israel, nor in the case of Saudi Arabia. And we need to put our weight firmly on the side of a process that brings together the grassroots groups who are actually making progress themselves between the Israelis and the Palestinians. They have human rights groups themselves that are beginning in a very effective way to establish trust, to build confidence, to build a sense of community. That's what we need to be supporting. So it's not us imposing our solution on them, but we need to stop supporting a flagrant offense against human rights in the form of the current Israeli government.
This question is for you as well, Dr. Stein. You said that the Iranian deal is not viewed as a threat by most intelligence services and that it should be used as a template to denuclearize the Middle East. My question is, who do you trust, either by name in terms of leaders or countries, who do you trust in the Middle East to help implement this policy?
You know, I think it's a question of negotiations, mm-hmm. and I think we need to sit down with not only with the Iranians, with the Israelis, with really Iraq, you know, with all of the countries of the Middle East to create a nuclear-free Middle East. You know, in the case of Iran, there was a question about Iran having a nuclear program in the future, and that was disputed by many intelligence agencies. But this was a future threat at worst, whereas there are countries right now who are violating nuclear agreements. Israel has nuclear weapons, and they're not supposed to. Pakistan, India. There are many countries that have nuclear weapons. We need to sit down with the Russians in particular, because we have the bulk of nuclear weapons. And right now we are investing $1 trillion in a new generation of nuclear weapons at a time when Mikhail Gorbachev, the former president of the Soviet Union. In his words, we are at the most dangerous nuclear weapons moment that we have ever been in history.
Since I got 20 seconds here, quick follow-up, since you mentioned Russia a couple times tonight, can you hit the reset button? Can you sit down with Russia after the accusation of what Putin has been alleged to do in this campaign?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, what Putin has been alleged to do is to have hacked. We hack all the time. I mean, and the Russians, in fact, have been trying to get us to sit down and collaborate on a treaty against cyber warfare. So, you know, I think we can have principled negotiations with the Russians about nuclear weapons and about cyber warfare.
Governor Johnson, another compatibility question for you. You have said that Iran is not a military threat, and yet you oppose the Iran deal on the grounds that Iran is, your words, the number one financier of terror around the world, close quote. How are those two statements compatible?
Well, I was skeptical of the Iran deal because they were and arguably may be a major funder of terrorism in the world. Now, with regard to the number, $165 billion, that is a number, or that is money that needs to be monitored as to whether or not that does end up in the hands of terrorists. And as president of the United States, I'm pledging to honor all treaties and obligations. So given that the Iran deal has been signed, I'm going to line up on the optimistic side that this actually will prevail, that surveillance, that monitoring is in place, and that we will be able to see and monitor that they are not engaged in the development of nuclear weapons. So I, like I say, I'm going to be optimistic about this deal, and I'm going to support this deal as president of the United States, but coming into it pessimistically, I think that's probably a good, that would be my overall, that would be my overall outlook on military intervention is I'm a skeptic.
Well, as president of the United States, Governor Johnson, how would you deal with this? The government is accepting, as we know at this moment, very few Syrian refugees, that is, and yet we continue to preach to the world about human rights. How would you handle that situation as president?
I think we should increase Syrian taking in Syrian refugees, believing that there will be and that there is a very intense vetting process taking place. When the debate occurred the other night between Clinton and Trump and they started talking about safe zones, the first thing that came to my mind was about six different questions. I'm not receiving national security briefings, but I'm going to guess that in those national security briefings, they were talking about safe zones. Well, safe zones, what does that mean? Does that mean boots on the ground? That is going to mean U.S. troops on the ground. And is that then not going to become a sanctuary for the Islamists and open then to getting attacked and that U.S. troops will lose their lives? I think a much more viable strategy would be to increase those refugees allowed into this country. And we could also step up funding, and we are funding refugees in the surrounding countries. So Jordan being one of those, we could increase that funding to allow more refugees safe havens in adjacent countries.
Same question for you, Dr. Stein. How do you square our not taking in more refugees with this notion of advancing human rights around the world?
Yeah, they can't be squared at all. Right now there are 65 million refugees around the world, which is tearing apart the Middle East and Europe and other places as well. And most of these refugees are being created by the wars that we have instigated largely. So we need to take responsibility for these refugees. We also need to stop these wars that continue to generate more. And that's where I think the weapons embargo and the freeze on the bank accounts of those countries who are continuing to fund terrorism, I think fundamentally you got to stop what's generating this problem. But in the meantime, we have to accept our proportional responsibility. And we need to take a large portion of the Syrian refugees that we have played so large a part in creating.
If you both give me a 30-second answer to this question, I think I can squeeze it in before this program ends. Our time runs so fast around here. You both propose to drastically cut military spending. How do you do that and keep us safe, Governor Johnson?
Well, the BRAC Commission itself in the mid-90s said that 25% more U.S. bases could have been closed, but the political will has not existed to see that take place. So Submitting a balanced budget to Congress, a 20% reduction in military spending will not compromise an invincible national defense.
So our bloated and dangerous military budget is not making us safer. It's making us less safe. So we need to cut back to where we were before 2001 because the military budget that we have right now is it's not helping us. It's consuming half of our discretionary budget. So we need to cut back. For example, this $1 trillion program in a new generation of nuclear weapons. That makes us less safe, not more safe. There are many ways that we can cut. And I just want to say, I hope we can do this again. I think this has been a really important debate. I hope Governor Johnson will consider doing more of these debates at a time when the American people are really clamoring for something other than these two candidates being rammed down their throat.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Built environments, or the way our neighborhoods are designed, can impact our health and well-being. My next guest is Dr. Richard Jackson. He's a pediatrician, professor, and the former chair of environmental health sciences at the Fielding School of Public Health at UCLA. He also designs healthy communities and environments as part of our special series on health and healthcare issues called Road to Health. Dr. Jackson tells us how. Good to have you on the program, sir.
Great to be back with you.
I want to talk about this built community, this built environment, and what role architecture plays in how healthy or unhealthy we are in this country.
Tavis, everything we look at was in somebody's mind at some point in the past. And we have created America to meet the needs of short-term investors, meet the needs of cars and highways, and return on investment. And we have not built America adequately to meet the needs of people. And we have not put people in the center of the things that we build. Mm-hmm. But realize everything around you was the product of someone's imagination. And when I teach at UCLA, I tell my students, look, the built environment is social policy in concrete. And when you have a social policy and you put barriers between people, it stays there for 100 years. So you've got to think about impacts on people up front.
One would think, and I'm not naive in saying this, but one would think that people would be the ultimate concern around the way we make considerations about how and where we build. But I hear you saying the exact opposite.
You know, when I teach, I show a picture of a subdivision with two houses 35 feet apart with a fence in between, and I say, you know, if Halloween's coming up and you want to take your daughter trick-or-treating with the neighbor over there, you would have to get in your car and drive 7 miles for 17 minutes to get to your neighbor's home. And we've actually designed America to meet the needs of cars, and yet one-third of our population does not drive. They're too old, they're too young, they're disabled, they're poor. And yet we keep leaving those people out. It's a kind of disenfranchisement that's really profound.
Yeah. If what I heard you say at the start of this conversation, and I'm being much more crass about it, you were much more ambassadorial about it, but more kind and charitable and generous.
I'm a pediatrician.
Yeah, I understand. I get it, and I'm not. So here it goes. If money is at the center of the reasons we make the decisions we make about the way we build cities, and money is always, you know, the end-all, be-all, how do you turn the tide against what we're talking about?
You know, our decisions have to be, in a way, top-down and bottom-up. And you have to have an engineer, you have to have an architect, you have to have people that know how to build a building. But they don't get to say everything. The community that lives there, the people that live there, need to have a voice. I'm very concerned. I teach at UCLA, and the folks that live near the Los Angeles River, the 51-mile river, they're the most overweight, the least physical activity, the least money, the worst health measurements of anyone. We need to create that river as a center of health in the city of Los Angeles. And yet people fear that what's going to happen is the deep money interests are going to come in, gentrify the place. In other words, drive poor people out. And the folks that have lived there for 2-3 generations will not have a place to live, and that all these relationships they had that they developed over the years will be lost. So we have to have people's voice, and we have to have the technical. It's also about people that know how to do this stuff.
Across the country, is the trend taking us in the right direction or the wrong direction?
I think with certain age groups, it's really getting much better. The millennials, the young people, particularly the ones that are well-educated and have life options, are moving to cities that are, there's small-scale retail. They don't want to endlessly go to franchise restaurants. They want to walk down streets that are interesting. They want to say hello to their neighbors. They want to live in, if you will, real America, the way we used to build places. Folks that don't have those options are often stuck. In fact, it's one of the worst places to live. One of the presidential candidates was talking about how bad the inner cities are, and from what I can tell, most of the young people want to live in the cities, and it's the first and second ring suburbs that are actually being more and more depressed. It's very hard to live in those places if you don't have a car, by the way, as most people know. So, and I'm also seeing something else is very interesting. Older folks are, you know, you get to 70, you can't run anymore very well. So you want a bicycle. You want to have a cultural life. You want to have decent restaurants. And so they're moving in as well. And the recent college graduates were up to their ears in debt are having a very hard time. Yeah. And so we've really got to build places that serve everybody.
Sounds to me, though, again, if that's what's drawing people into these urban centers, then the way we draw things ought to be commensurate with that.
You know, and the young people that are doing this really want to do this. You know, I'm thinking about, I think some of the, you know, obviously everybody knows San Francisco, Portland, the New York, Brooklyn are drawing people in. A lot of the middle-sized cities, I was in Las Cruces recently, where they're losing their young people, and they're going to, the city will die if they continue to lose their young people. And so creating a downtown that really attracts people and makes them want to stay there is very high on the mayor and the city councils. And it's no longer, let's give some company a great big tax break and have them move in and have them move out after 5 years.
Does it have to be either or? Can it be both and?
You know, it has to be. Because people need jobs. And people need meaning in their lives. And we need culture. And one of the things I like about Los Angeles is the mix of different cultures that are here that I live in L.A. without a car. Yeah. And
Wait, hold up. how do you do that?
I do rent them sometimes when I really need to go at a distance, but yeah. I live near the UCLA campus and I walk all the time or I take the bus and I love the cultural mix in the bus.
Yeah. You think folk can be convinced to do that in a city like L.A.? L.A. is clearly not the only city like this, but in cities where we have become so accustomed to spending all of our time in our cars. How do you change that sort of mindset? Is that possible?
There's a ballot on the here in Los Angeles. We're in the process of spending the first $30 billion in sales tax on subways, and we now have a subway to the sea. They opened up that expo line, and within a month that all the cars were crowded, they had to move it to, like, coming every 7 minutes. You have now can get a subway to the beach. And I hope Los Angeles gets the Olympics in 2024. I want to see a subway stop right near our university because people don't want to drive. When I moved here, the first thing somebody said to me is, make sure you like where you live because once you get there, you're not going to want to go anywhere because it's too hard to go anywhere in our very crowded cities. When I was born, there was only 140 million people in the United States. We're at 340 million. We just can't be this crowded and think cars are going to solve our problems.
Yeah. Not to mention the impact on the environment.
Well, the other thing I worry about is when I was a young pediatrician, I'd go to the children's diabetes clinic, and all the children had juvenile diabetes, insulin dependent. Nowadays, half the kids have adult onset diabetes. We call it type 2 diabetes. And we're looking at a diabetes epidemic. We're spending 2% of all the money in the United States on that one disease. Can you imagine? And about 15%, 14% of our adults have diabetes, and another 35% have pre-diabetes. So we're looking at an avalanche. The only thing that works, you know, you got to watch what you eat. You have to do a lot of other things. You also have to walk. And anything time we take walking away from our citizenry, we're depriving them of years of life, of freedom, and of happiness.
It's one thing to get this message through to everyday fellow citizens, and that isn't easy, obviously, hence the reason for doing these Road to Health segments on this program, you know, so many times over the course of the year. I think it's important, even if it isn't sexy and doesn't.
I think it's sexy.
Well. I think it's important. I guess the question is, as difficult as it is to get that message, that all-important message through to fellow citizens, it's, I think, perhaps even more important to get that message through to policymakers. Do they hear that? Do they care about that? Are they motivated by that if it doesn't come with a contribution?
The bright young policymakers absolutely get it. Mm-hmm. And I think business people, there's something called the Urban Land Institute, mm-hmm. big developers, they actually are trying, they've done a whole series of guidelines about how you build for health. And one of the mantras in there is, make the healthy choice the easy choice. Because wagging your finger at somebody and saying, go for a walk, doesn't work.
Yeah.
What really works is to give people environments that are enticing. You know, when you were a kid, if there was a good place to play and there was something to do, you wanted to go out. You didn't have to be told to sit there on the chair. You went out and looked for things that brought joy and activity in your lives. And that's what we need to be doing.
What's fascinating about this to me, this is another subject for another time. What's really fascinating about this conversation for me, though, is that in an environment where, or I should say in a year, where we've gone through this, or this, I'm trying to be nice, this presidential campaign where all the focus is on the federal government, it is local cities that really impact our lives more than the federal government. In so many ways, that's where the real decisions are made about how we live our lives, and that's where decisions are made, I think, that can help us to become more healthy in the end.
You know, I think every elected official, senator or president for that matter, should have been a mayor, because mayors really have a lot of influence over what's built. And we've got some great mayors, Joe Riley in Charleston and John Norquist, who was in Milwaukee, who have really thought about how to construct and make their cities, and not simply always be looking for the next big donor. The worst thing you can do to a downtown is put in a great big car lot, even though they generate a lot of sales tax.
Yeah.
And so we have to think about the tax policies under this, too.
Yeah, very important. Dr. Jackson, good to see you.
Great to see
Thanks
you,
Thanks for
Terrence.
Coming
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Oscar and Grammy Award winner Carol Bayer-Sager is one of the most prolific songwriters in pop history. Her songs have been performed by musical giants like Michael Jackson, Neil Diamond, and Aretha Franklin. Now she's telling her own story in a memoir. It's called They're Playing Our Song. Carol Bayer-Sager,
it's an honor to have you on this program.
Oh, it's an honor to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for coming to see us. You start your days every day the same way my mother starts her days, on your knees in prayer.
Yes, I do. I wasn't even going to put that in the book, but my husband said, I hope you wrote in the book about how you say your prayer every morning. And I said, why would I say that? And he said, because it's very unusual, which I didn't know, but I do. I get down on my hands and knees every morning and I say a prayer, which sets an intention for the day, and I pray for friends who are in need of healing. I just pray for God's will and to have Him lead me in the way that He would do what He would have me do. And I've just done it for so many years. I can't imagine not doing it.
Yeah. How did you become a person of faith? Is that a fair question?
It's a fair question, because I wasn't as a young person and young child. In fact, I found little faith in my own religion because my initial family of origin was not a feeling of safety for me. Mm-hmm. And then we'd go to temple and I would see all the people outside talking about each other, and I thought, well, this doesn't feel protective or loving, or so I didn't connect to that. And it was many years later, actually. I studied many different religions. I studied Buddhism. I studied Hinduism. I meditated. And then I found Kabbalah, which is the spiritual arm of the Jewish religion. Some Jews don't approve of it, but I found a lot of helpful suggestions in how to change my life on a daily basis through the study of Kabbalah. And just through, I guess, so many books that I read, and I kind of have my own relationship with my higher power, but I really believe that I'm guided.
Yeah. the thing I found most fascinating about the text, about the book, particularly about your life journey, is that as a child, you are bullied, you are chubby, a very aggressive, I want to be generous here, a very aggressive mother, tough mother.
You could say that.
Yeah, a tough mother. Loved your father, loved both your parents, but really loved your father. Tough mother. Anyway, from that childhood that you were referencing a moment ago where you said you didn't feel that kind of love, the most interesting dynamic and dichotomy for me is that for a child who grows up that way, you end up writing such beautiful love songs.
Well, you know, I think, first of all, I think that childhood made me who I am today. Mm-hmm. So today I bless it. I forgive my mom completely because...
That's the point, though. You could have been bitter, though.
I could have been, but I so realized that if she had been more nurturing or less critical, I wouldn't have had the need to be seen and heard. And the safest way for me to be heard was through writing my feelings and someone else expressing them. As a little girl, I had a ventriloquist act, yeah, and the dummy could say things for me that I couldn't say for myself. So the natural extension was, well, I loved music all my life. I loved music. As a little girl, I wrote lyrics to other people's songs on the radio. Mm-hmm. And then at camp, I wrote the theme songs at camp, and it was just clear to me always that I wanted to write songs, but again, I could put my feelings out there and not have to own them because someone else was singing them. Mm-hmm. That was the beginning. And as I write in the book, songwriting became the safest lane in my life. When I was writing songs, all my fears of illness and dying went away, all my fears of the bomb exploding, all my fears of... I mean, I walked around with a tremendous amount of fear and anxiety that no one really knew because I had a very calm facade, even though when nighttime came, all my fear remembered me and I couldn't sleep. And, you know, I wasn't very present in my own life. But in that lane of songwriting, everything was always perfect.
But that requires a courage. It requires a certain amount of transparency. Even though you aren't saying it, you still have to come out of yourself with what you put on paper. So tell me more about that process, about being courageous enough and transparent enough to put what you were feeling onto paper.
Well, I usually didn't write my lyrics out. I respond when I hear music.
Right.
And I'm probably the most collaborative person I know.
Yeah,
and I think part of that was not having a strong self at the time. I had this ability in collaboration because I wrote with a lot of people who were going to be recording the songs, starting with Melissa Manchester and Peter Allen and onward. And so I was able to sort of morph into what I thought they needed me to be, mm-hmm, and yet stay true to my own feelings when I wrote lyrics. So, and when I wrote lyrics, often they were like songs to my future self. Like, I remember writing a song early on with Melissa Manchester called Home to Myself, mm-hmm, which so many women came up to me and said, oh, that song got me through a really difficult time. Well, I didn't feel that I had found that place, that home to myself at the time, but I hoped I would. And I did. Finally, I did, mm-hmm, way later in life. But I think that many of my songs were hopes for the future. Mm-hmm. They were messages of love that I wanted to feel and wanted to give, and unrequited love. That was easy for me. 'Cause that I knew from.
Yeah.
But I think some of the things that made me a really good collaborator were the same things that made me not feel completely whole as a person,
yeah,
for a while.
There are a lot of folks, though, who are gifted and talented, as you clearly are, who don't like to run in the collaboration lane because it requires sharing, it requires what collaboration requires, working with someone else, as opposed to letting your artistic vision guide the process. So how did you get comfortable with sharing the stage, sharing the spotlight, sharing the creativity?
Well, I love the feedback.
Yeah, yeah.
I just love the feedback. I love, first of all, whoever I write with in my music room or theirs, there's sort of an unspoken rule. Nobody's going to edit anybody.
Right.
And as my friend David Foster, another great songwriter, producer,
we'll talk about the prayer a little bit later.
He says, don't strangle it while it's in the cradle.
Yeah.
So I don't edit myself.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I'll say a line and you can say, Carol, that's awful. And that's okay. I'll just keep. But I love the feedback that as I'm hearing your melody and I'm singing lyrics and maybe even changing a line or two of your melodies, except with Burt Bacharach, where he didn't let me change a single note.
Yeah.
But I like you to say, no, no, give me something better. As opposed to if I was doing it alone, I didn't have that voice that would say to myself, give me something better.
But you're never offended by that, though.
No, I like it. I welcome it.
Yeah, yeah,
I welcome it because maybe I'm just so used to it as a child, you know.
Yeah.
But no, it makes me dig deeper and reach for more to have that feedback.
Yeah. Since you mentioned David Foster, and I'll cut in right quick because I wanted to make sure that I didn't forget. Tell me about this, about The Prayer, the song that you've done more than one, but the collaboration with David Foster.
David Foster and I wrote The Prayer for a unsuccessful animated film called The Quest for Camelot.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the young girl, the heroine, was going off into a dangerous situation, as most all do in animated films.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to David, I think we should write a prayer that the mother sings as she lets her daughter go. And he said, that's a good idea. And he started playing. He's so facile, so he just starts playing some chords. And I think my most famous phrase throughout my life is when I hear something that I sort of like, that they're just about to pass by and go to something else, I go, what's that? Play that again. Play that again. I want to hear that. And so he went back, and I said, that's so pretty. But play around there. And he's played a line, and I went, I love that. Let's say, I pray you'll be our eyes. And then all of a sudden, words that weren't there 3 minutes before start to come to me and flow with what he's finding as a melody.
Mm.
And it's my favorite way to write because I feel like we're one. I feel like when it's all right, when the lyric fits the melody and the melody fits the lyric and the song becomes more because of the marriage of the two, that's my favorite way to write. And I have to be cautious because David is so brilliant and can make anything sound great in 1 second, as can Babyface, as can Carole King, as can All My Life. Mm-hmm. I've written with people who you hear them and you go, oh, wow, this is a hit. With David, we got Celine Dion to sing the song in the film, and then we got Andrea Bocelli to sing it with her at the end credit. And when I heard that, I just went, this is everything I've ever wanted to say in my life, and it's greater than even the song was. It took on an even higher meaning when it was sung by these two heaven-like voices.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsi Abuadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.